Welcome back to Unchanging Education with me, Dan Clemens. So we're continuing with fellow teachers, and I may as well take one brief moment just to highlight the fact that Philip Reif fits into my general critique and literature review of problematizing so-called student-centered thinking or pedagogy, or learner-centered, different forms. That in a way, this becomes a kind of a catch-all term to bring in a lot of ideas, practices, policies that may not in themselves be particularly conducive to a good, effective education. It certainly seems to contrast with a kind of a classical approach to teaching. And we can certainly see that Reif contrasts with this philosophy of student-centered learning. And we're picking up here on page 38, where he starts talking about obedience to old authority. Here he's talking about an authoritative past that is partly characterized by a following of interdicts, of kind of hard and fast rules that are followed rather than questioned or broken. And so let me just pick up here. Old authority cannot begin to make its next right and proper claim upon our capacity for obedience through teaching in the classroom. Until there are vast numbers of true parents, we cannot expect vast numbers of true teachers or true students. How can we teachers expect to achieve disciplines of the feeling intellect so late in the student day and in a cultureless society, one that divorces us from the interdicts? So one interesting thing here is he's saying that teaching is perhaps not even possible in a cultureless society, and that the very existence of true teachers is dependent upon the pre-existence of true parents. He continues on the next page. To be radically contemporaneous. Again, this radical contemporaneity is the opposite of an authoritative past. To be sprung loose from every particular symbolic is to achieve a conclusive, unanswerable failure of historical memory. Historical memory, authoritative past, old authority. Unanswerable failure of historical memory. This is the uniquely modern achievement. Barbarians have never before existed. At the end of this tremendous cultural development, we moderns shall arrive at barbarism. Barbarians are people without historical memory. Barbarism is the real meaning of radical contemporaneity. Released from all authoritative pasts, we progress towards barbarism, not away from it. So here he's kind of attacking this idea that, well, if we can free ourselves from the past, then we can become more enlightened or more sophisticated, that we have to shake off the chains of bad tradition that weigh on the mind like a nightmare, as, you know, to paraphrase Marx. One interesting thing here about feeling intellect is, and I know I've reached back to this Bertrand Russell quote a number of times, where he says the correct attitude in studying a philosopher is neither contempt nor reverence, not to love or hate them, but a kind of a hypothetical sympathy until you know how it feels to believe or to think what they think. This requires that one uncritically think and feel their way inside of a particular theory or thinker. And there's a problem emerges with a kind of a fetishization of critical thinking, that to be too critical too early can lead to a very serious problem of not letting ideas in. Especially, you know, a knee-jerk rejection of old ideas in favor of new ideas. And that this, to exist in that milieu, can make the standard of teaching that I think Reef is reaching for, can make that impossible. Okay, continuing. He continues in this screed about barbarians. Now, the barbarians are taking over. The barbarians being classically defined as people without a history, or as he said on the previous page, of having no historical memory, and dwelling most naturally in America, a country dominated by an ingenuous will to transform without regard to what is being destroyed and what is being constructed. This is another key distinction between teacher-centered and student-centered, that student-centered is almost obsessed with this idea of transformation, to transform something. Whereas to transmit something from the past, to participate in a continuity between past, present, and future, that the great teachers of the present are teaching the past to young people who will, in a sense, inherit the future. And we have a duty to pass on what was passed on to us, to be a link in the chain, not to radically reimagine or to transform. The source of the trouble is the revolutionary activity of the bourgeoisie, he continues. So having a sense of history, or maybe participating in this continuity, in a sense, frees us from descending into barbarism. And again, this seems to be the opposite assumption that is often held in a kind of a critical pedagogy, that the past is the source of barbarity, and we have to liberate ourselves from the past in order to become more than mere barbarians, and to transform through a kind of revolutionary activity. Okay, continuing. Science mocked by armies of intellectualizing bureaucrats who have learned the trick of calling themselves scientists. What has science to do with bureaucracy? As well, reduce interdicts to rules. That in an increasingly bureaucratic and scientistic culture, or culturelessness for Reef, that these interdicts that are not just ideas or rules expressed as thou shalt not, but they are deeply held and deeply felt, that they are absorbed in an uncritical fashion, especially early on, for young people, earlier in their student lives. Now, certainly, to a mature, you know, feeling intellectual person, anything can be questioned or challenged, but even then, we think that Reef would not really think much of some of this activity, or at least he wouldn't think it's very productive. That any kind of pseudo-intellectual activity that always wants to ask, you know, why not do things in this transgressive, inverse way? You know, maybe what we all accept as bad is actually good, and what is thought to be good is bad. One culture cannot be created by holding sensitivity sessions for scientists. The reading of novels and poetry as part of a new humanism suitable to the age of science makes no more sense than all the interdisciplinary remedies that would make the literary take a course in basic science, whatever is basic to science at a particular historical moment. So he kind of sees this vast assemblage of science and bureaucracy And these sensitivity sessions certainly seem to suggest the therapeutic culture. And when he's talking about these interdisciplinary remedies, we imagine that there's a kind of a disdain here, that this is kind of one way to understand the, what he calls the problem-solving racket of ways in which educational spaces position themselves into doing things that are radically contemporaneous, radically contemporary, that we're just doing, you know, problem solving or critical thinking or interdisciplinary sensitivity sessions, and we reduce the real powerful truths, like the in the way that an interdict is a deeply held and felt creed, reducing any kind of authority just to a mere rule, a rule that can be followed or not. That there's a, it may seem that there's an intellectual activity going on by critically questioning everything and thinking critically about critical thinking itself. But he would just see that, again, as radical contemporaneity, as circular and ultimately unproductive and remissive. That it may not be a direct, even when this kind of activity is not a direct inversion of the older way or style of thinking or educating, it at least may sort of sidestep it, or just this idea of question everything that I think we spontaneously like as educators can certainly become a kind of a golem. That there are some things that we want to start off as basic presuppositions of things that are that we already know to be good or bad. Continuing, a humanistic science, again, here I think he's still thinking of what we would call interdisciplinarity, must remain as meaningless as modern social criticism, so long as it seeks to tamper with the interdictory nature of authority. Again, deeply held, firm, fast rules that can come out of any kind of a rich cultural tradition, and to tamper with them is what he sees in a lot of the contemporary activity, especially in education and in a therapeutic culture. Quote, the life of the mind cannot tolerate the deceit of its own infinite malleability. Again, I think he's so prescient in these pages of thinking of the mind as infinitely malleable, and anything can be good or bad or thought or practiced, that it's almost like we're starting from a kind of a year zero, that we know nothing, when we need to be critical of everything. And he would just say that this is this kind of shifting quicksand simply cannot be the basis for a culture, that it is an anti-culture. And just endlessly thinking of things as they were and things as they are, and endlessly asking, you know, why is it like that, or why not this way? Why can't it be otherwise? That this is, it's a mistake to think of this as productive intellectual engagement, that it fails to meet a standard of feeling intellect. Modern criminals and would-be revolutionaries are not creatures of impulse, as in the 19th century imagination, but more and more often, I suspect, driven creatures of high principle, militants of this immediacy and that. Rapists grow didactic. Apostles of the body flaunt their principles. Who is not to have his say and express himself fully? It is a resolute contradiction in terms for the superego to express itself chiefly in transgressive activity. So, one thing he's saying here is that there is a kind of a new modern contemporary commandment, and that commandment is to transgress, or at least not to conform, but rather that there is a pressure to transgress, to violate reliably good extant understandings of culture. And that expressiveness and impulse are characteristic of this kind of modern criminality of, well, he says would-be revolutionaries, but I would think of it perhaps as these self-styled revolutionaries who ultimately equate freedom as simply freedom from the old authoritative past. And certainly he's suggesting that this is a kind of a false freedom. That I think, in a way, I think Reif thinks that we already have he doesn't really talk about a priori, but I would suppose that there's an innate understanding of what we should and should not do, and that we can be clever in thinking and practicing out of those kinds of understandings in transgressive activity. How pompous our cultural revolutionaries are about their morality and all its preachments of honesty, lightness, and play. Our academic world is full of sniffpecks who are full of abject snobberies about their effortful liberations from the morality of self-concealment. So certainly one aspect of morality for Reif is this self-concealment, rather than the endless expressional quest of a therapeutic anti-culture. This devotion to impulse and expression and the effortful liberation from good social conduct that depends upon following a complex set of inherited rules and understandings. An extraordinarily rare talent does not emerge in transgressions. Rather, in works of art or science that control their own spheres with full interdictory force called form. Within its culture, every artwork constitutes a system of discrete limits, each a paradigm of how a culture works. None are sovereign beyond themselves. A universal culture is a contradiction in terms. So I think, certainly a younger version of myself would not have accepted this as a kind of a self-styled radical revolutionary Marxist critical theory thinker. That we would think in that modality that rare talent does precisely emerge from transgression, that it's always a departure from what is or what is being done. But this is a false apprehension, a misapprehension, that to be great in any of these individual small-c cultures, art, science, that a truly extraordinarily rare talent emerges through a kind of a disciplined studentship and an attentiveness to the established form. That you have to really master the existing field before you can really offer any kind of original contribution to it. But there is just a fantasy that is very hard to shake, that originality and creativity are radical and even destructive departures of common accepted understandings. Our re-educated classes, rich consumers of everything available, are scarcely competent to perform the most elementary decencies. Yet they are urged to fulfill themselves, as if each were a Beethoven, perhaps a little deaf to his own music and in need of some third-year hygiene. Freud called psychoanalysis a re-education. In our own time, post-Freudian, everything new is a re-education. Minds fawn over mindlessness and tries to find fancy names for it. So the therapeutic teaching of transgressive behavior confuses art and life. It confuses rare genius and common faith. It confuses public life and private. Encounter group teachings, for example, mainly by therapists of the revolutionary rich, follow the precedent set by the technological radicalism of those same rich in their earlier scramble for more. So this is a long passage here, but I think back to this quote about everyone thinking of themselves as a kind of a Beethoven, that we have, and it, this is sort of an analogy for the endless expressional quest, that we all have so much depth and richness within us that we need to express, and we can't waste time by, you know, learning and mastering the existing form, that we can start off in this purely creative, formless space, and simply by expressing ourselves and acting on impulse, that we can create something, you know, truly valuable and, you know, an original contribution to culture in some way. Continue. In the name of humanization, false guilt subverts the interdicts, the old rules, basically, by proclaiming that everything human is permitted. And I should reach back to that previous passage where he says, you know, so many people that are incapable of basic decencies or common faith, this kind of baseline of a good, productive citizen. That people who haven't really even mastered the basics of like politeness and good manners still seem to think of themselves in this, really, I think he's implying in this narcissistic way, thinking of themselves as Beethovens with this depth that simply has to be expressed, as if they're a kind of a conduit for some infinite creative power, like a god, and that they're a communicator of something eternal and infinite. The radical psychologizers have greatly increased the incidence of false guilt because culture cannot tolerate such direct openings of possibility. So in order to maintain a culture constantly directing openings of possibility, whereas everyone is a kind of a formless, expressive artist acting on impulse and, you know, creating and destroying, that culture simply cannot sustain this. It's reminiscent of a more contemporary understanding of the overproduction of a cultural bourgeoisie. I think that's almost exactly what Reif is kind of getting at here. I suppose that's in the more contemporary use of that term, that it seems quite economic that all these people with several degrees, they all become overqualified in the pejorative sense and refuse to do the good basic kinds of things required of working citizens, that we all need to be creatively satisfied in any kind of productive activity. And there's that there's just an overproduction here. And much in the way that teaching has to be a job that normal people can be expected to do reasonably well and not overburdening certain kinds of roles in society with, you know, too much impossible expectations. At once, when nothing is handed down slowly, in generational dances of time, sociology awaits its theorists in the classic style. Since the positivist takeover in the first third of the 19th century, my discipline, he's talking about sociology, has tried too hard to remain permanently advanced, young enough to produce an endless barrage of originalities. Such youthfulness and originality, trendiness, some call it, are fatal to the life of the mind. It's a fantastic line here. I'm going to continue on. Violent excursions toward death and perverse behavior are occupations most fit for the young, when they will not think through what their predecessors have thought. Thinking through the thoughts of our predecessors or predecessors is going to cause these violent excursions. Now, they might seem to be youthful and original trendiness, but again, this endless barrage of originality is fatal to the life of the mind. That there has to be a disciplined approach to the existing and pre-existing form. And perhaps the greatest quote, this is just a visionary passage, but this final sentence here: to leave the great past unremembered is to be lost in the howling present. Then the best an intellectual can do is shoot off his mouth. I think I remember it imperfectly in a way that makes more sense to me. I often think of it, instead of being lost, to be adrift. And instead of to shoot off his mouth, to shoot off at the mouth. To leave the great past unremembered is to be adrift in the howling present. Then the best an intellectual can do is shoot off at the mouth. That it would seem that an intellectual in this mode might have something, you know, truly new and revolutionary to contribute, being separated and divorced from the weight of old authority or tradition or any relation to the past. But what he's saying here is it's just the opposite. Someone who has no real disciplined command of the past, actually that prevents them from being able to make any kind of genuinely original contribution. It prevents anything of meaning or value from emerging. And in a way, a radically contemporaneous, therapeutic anti-culture has this exactly backwards, and he's trying to undo or trying to revert. And again, that fits in very well with the theme of unchanging education, unchanging a culture that's become an anti-culture back into a culture, if possible. The barbarian who is emerging, stuffed with tactical advice culled from the ages, can hop from order to order, committing himself, as in modern marriage, to a serial monogamy that is massively polygamous. So the barbarian is not steeped in any tradition, and he's kind of making a shot here at modern marriage, that you cannot hop from different styles and different tactics, that you have to be steeped in a kind of knowledge tradition. But he comes back to this a number of times, order hopping, hopping from one order or one set of rules and understandings to another. This, and again, this is very common. I mean, this basically what he's describing is interdisciplinarity, that it becomes a kind of an excuse for not really being deeply steeped in any to liberating oneself from the task of becoming deeply knowledgeable. To say this barbarian is universally faithless is only to say that no character becomes authoritative in him. I think this is an important distinction here. Character belongs to a different order than personality. Personality is modern, therapeutic, and there are personalities and lifestyles and preferences. But character is something older and richer and deeper that I think Farif is becoming lost. Only cultureless societies can exist without presiding presence. So a presiding presence is sticking with one order. In this analogy, it's just being unfailingly true to your wife. That there is a kind of a non-negotiable sense of good and bad and right and wrong that is deep and unchanging, that it's authoritative in you, it's interdictory and non-negotiable, and why not do it the complete opposite way is not seriously entertained. Character is authoritative in you as a presiding presence in a way that personality is not authoritative and it's not presiding. Personality is this order hopping of serial monogamy as a kind of a euphemism for polygamy. No presence can preside, which is to say no character can exist, when all are subject to abandonments, quick as their adoptions. These pages here, right at the end of the first third of this book, it's just Reef just hitting the nail on the head over and over again. And in a way, this order hopping, interdisciplinarity, critical thinking, the problem solving racket, it all fits together. That there's no weight of knowledge weighing it down, and no sense, a radical liberation from any kind of a capital T transcendental truth. So, we're constantly just hopping from one order to another, from one, adopt something and abandon it, adopt something else and abandon that. That there's nothing really sturdy or stable. And this, I think maybe we can think of character as a kind of a verb, and we can think of creed as the corresponding noun. He writes, where creeds were, there therapies will be. Right? A creed as a non-negotiable set of rules for life. For one, and we can see this, maybe that there is a... once this therapeutic anti-culture becomes the dominant culture, something like Jordan Peterson's rules for life or rules for living can become a kind of a new counterculture, and that it seeks to reinstate a creedal character person. Our new way, re-education, is an unlearning. What then have we to teach? That teachers are no longer really teaching. There is no more education. There is no more learning. When we have this anti-culture that has taken over, I mean, the culture of civilization, but again, keeping it more specific to education, all we have are re-educations and unlearnings, that we're doing you know, critical theory as anti-education. So I'm going to go back again. Our passionate truths are so provisional. They move so quickly with the electrified times that none can prepare us to receive them deeply into ourselves as character. Again, hopping from orders polygamously, not committed in any way. Merely a negative commitment to uncommitment itself. Committing to the non-committal self. They do not become compelling in their interdicts. We don't make unquestionable rules for ourselves in our lives, but endlessly attractive in their remissions. Let me just reread the whole passage here together without my jumping in so much. I think it'll be beneficial. To say this barbarian is universally faithless is only to say that no character becomes authoritative in him. Only cultureless societies can exist without presiding presences. No presence can preside when all are subject to abandonments quick as their adoptions. Our passionate truths are so provisional, they move so quickly with the electrified times, that none can prepare us to receive them deeply into ourselves as character. They do not become compelling in their interdicts, but endlessly attractive in their remissions. Where creeds were, their therapies will be. Our new way, re-education, is in unlearning. Then, what then have we to teach? Okay, continuing. In the therapeutic, I imagined someone who takes nothing seriously. Of course, a therapeutic can resonate empty militancies that signal an acceptance of their emptiness. Order hoppers, therapeutics, charismatics, they don't really take anything seriously, but they can resonate empty militancies. They might seem to be very strongly for or against something, but they're only for or against it as the flavor of the week, and they're hopping to some other order next, right? That they quickly abandon things, they quickly adopt new things. What might seem like passionate truths in electrified times, they're just provisional. None of them are received deeply. So in a way, we can see how this critique of culture and how it manifests in education also maps on quite neatly to the new kind of student, the new kind of graduate, right? If we judge education by its fruits, then we look at the products, like the, we can ask ourselves about the distinction between the more and the lesser educated people in our society, and judge on the basis of the fruits of the tree. The new society already has the look, both in America and in the Soviet Union, of a hospital theater, in contrast to the old society, which had the look of a church. The old society that has the look of a church will be characterized as creedal, as having a creed with interdicts that produces character, rather than the new society, the therapeutic society, the hospital theater. And we hear this phrase a lot in people who are critical of the young student activist revolutionary types as theater kids. And that this theatricality often seems wedded to this therapeutic culture, this of a kind of a heightened sensitivity, you know, that that words or violence, I think, captures this idea of hospital theater, you know, connected by a dash as kind of a single phrase, and that it's that it contrasts very much to a society that looks like a church. I think this idea actually comes from Goethe. I think maybe he comes back to this later in the book and attributes it. The successor to our failed creedal organizations will not be another creedal one. Again, this is order hopping, right? It's not that a new organized culture emerges. It's just a disorganized anti-culture. Will not be another creedal one, not even Marxist, which names the last major creedal effort to reorganize Western society. We shall be dominated by anti-creeds and think ourselves free. But we won't be free. The Gospels were not good news. The ungospeled present has its supremely pleasant feature, the death of the church, or, less pleasant, its conversion into naively therapeutic institutions. It's saying it's not just that our society becomes styled after a hospital theater rather than styled after a church. It's also that he's talking really about capture here. Also that churches become hospital theaters as well, hawking a few antique graces to ornament our triumphant gracelessness. That he's just saying it's a facade. It is one of the ways that an anti-creedal culture hides the fact that it has no creed, no deeply held truths, and no character. And to hide the fact that it has no grace, it has to adorn itself in this performative gracefulness. One necessary thing that we inactivists, we academic men, suspicious of all politics, have to teach our students is how not to invest in the nostrums of direct action, now being hawked, being sold. It is our duty to protect and nurture in our academies a few enclaves within which to practice an inhibiting subtlety. That subtlety and inhibition map onto character and culture. This totally uninhibited, totally flagrant, expressive impulse, desire, is ultimately barbaric for Reef, right? An inhibiting subtlety is a more desirable template for studentship. And I think it is Reef who introduces this idea of inactivism, right? That academic men suspicious of politics teach students not to be invested in nostrums of direct action, that the key to becoming a well-educated, feeling intellectual, possessed of knowledge, and having a kind of a deeply rooted character of a presiding presence, that activism only in a way... It seems to lead far too many young people astray, that this is the productive activity that they should spend their young lives doing. And what Reef is saying here is that we have a duty to guide students away. There's also a very great quote by Michael Oakeshott, where he talks about how a university ought to be a space where all of the hot allegiances of young life and of life outside the university, this kind of, Hobbesian war of all against all, that are really a space that is truly conducive to learning, is a space apart, that you don't need to be for or against this side or that side. That is in a way the great virtue of a university. And when universities become, well, they become their opposite. These are transgressive anti-universities, the ones that teach students they have to be activists, engage in direct action, that they already have all the answers to politics, and that the easy slogans and answers and solutions to history and politics and economics, that these are all readily handed down and easily available, and they just require direct action to do them, that we already know. I mean, as Marx said, that his own theory was the answer, it was the solution to the riddle of history, right? Inhibiting subtlety and inactivism is the ticket for Reef. Of one condition that could make him less capable of brutality, the therapeutic conqueror of his feeling intellect, which means getting rid of this pesky presiding presence, an authoritative presence of a feeling intellect, is likely to be incapable inwardness, the quality of self-concealment. Self-concealment, inhibiting subtlety. There's another way that he expresses this exact same idea. I think it's in the passage about Beethoven. People scarcely competent to perform the most elementary decencies, right? An elementary decentness, same kind of idea, I think, as this inwardness of self-concealment, of inhibiting subtlety, that these are, in a way, the practices of character, feeling intellect, inactivism. And he references Kierkegaard in this respect. An autonomous inner man, what is referred to as inner and autonomous. Okay, jumping ahead a few pages. So from Kierkegaard to Kafka, a genius at reflecting willing victims used the gag, but victims are not born, they are re-educated, their minds too much broadened. In cultures of truth, the object of education is to narrow the mind. Fantastic. So one useful way to think of this is that we often think of the distinct departments and faculties in universities as disciplines. And discipline is to narrow. That we often think of people go to university to broaden their, expand their horizons. But in a way, we can also think of just the opposite. That in an undisciplined way that is unburdened by any kind of a dutiful adherence to a particular form, that any kind of idea, why not, with no possibility of any kind of authoritative answer to, or any satisfying solution to like a whole host of possible thoughts and problems, that this by making the mind and experience more broad and wide and open, this is not necessarily the direction that education goes in. That a narrowing, a focus, and again, going back to the university idea, that you know students will have a concentration, and that even a master's degree is lesser than a doctorate, right? Doctorate suggests teaching, and the way it was explained to me that a master's, even though I don't know, I guess I suppose in a way it can sound like it's loftier or higher than a doctorate, but it just means to master one particular narrow niche within a broader discipline. That academics is in some ways predicated upon this specialization. Now there is a downside risk to over-specialization, losing touch with a kind of a common sense realism. But minds that become too broadened in their re-education is disagreeable. In cultures of truth, the object of education is to narrow the mind. And I think that interdisciplinarity is offensive to Reif for that reason. Okay, so coming back to in my notes, I always write EEQ, the endless expressional quest. Reif uses that on multiple pages here coming up. The endless expressional quest. Again, thinking that everyone thinking of themselves as a Beethoven when they're not even capable of elementary decency. The endless expressional quest belongs to art, with its absolute systems of limit, unchallengeable within the work itself. Because life cannot be made over into a work of art. The endless expressional quest can never belong to it. What destructiveness is implied in our desire to make life extraordinary? Existence is broken enough without inducing breakthroughs, as if thus to be graced. In this way, we know that being graced turns into its opposite, a cosmos in which nobody minds. Endless expressional quest, life, he says, really cannot be made into a work of art. A work of art is like a limited and finite thing. And the most interesting part here is this relationship between destructiveness and the desire to make life extraordinary. I think maybe this is an example of hyperintention, that certainly there's nothing bad or wrong about an extraordinary life, but only when the desire to make it extraordinary with an almost kind of obsessive focus, that this in a way leads to a destructiveness, or that destructiveness is required in order to assert this desire towards the extraordinary. That may be just the opposite, that accepting the ordinariness and quelling this desire and being less destructive by being less intentional is a better pathway to the extraordinary. Art and other defensive achievements are the forms within which the endless expressional quest is temporarily constrained. That there's nothing wrong with expressiveness and art and creativity, of course not. But I think when it's not attached to a kind of a form, to a tradition, when it's totally undisciplined, then when it's totally unconstrained in its endlessness, then it can only be destructive. Okay, skipping ahead again. That the most compelling and yet avoidable interdicts are those buried deep in character, implies their exterior existence. So the only way to see the deep character and the interdicts that live as an authoritative and presiding presence inside one, that they have a relationship to an exterior existence. Now, Reef isn't quite saying that we can judge a book by its cover, but I think that there's that idea is suggested here. A culture that engages itself to the interminable opening of possibility issues its own death warrant. Again, this is just totally anathema to the modern critical therapeutic activistic type of education or anti-education that is being peddled. Opening possibilities. Reef is saying, yeah, sure. I mean, constantly opening new and new possibilities and hopping from order to order, having no presiding presence or character or interdicts that are deeply held within yourself. This is just a cultural death warrant. Apostles and advertisers of the opening of possibility as life or progress or better living through chemistry. These slogans and nostrums have adopted the transgressive rather than the interdictory style, the hospital theater rather than the church style as their own. And so, even more certainly than the apostles of our preceding church civilization invited violence as their disciplinary means in defense of the interdicts, the apostles of a cultureless society invite violence as an emancipatory means. What he's really saying is the old style culture would only ever use violence to defend itself and to defend its order. And this new style only uses violence to change or to upend. That it uses violence negatively, we might say. That violence to change. Violence as an offensive attacking direction rather than the necessity of the only excusable use of violence is a kind of a self-defense or a defense of one's order, of one's culture, of one's character, etc. The swarming apostles of life, and he's using capital L life here, like capital L life or capital P progress, that these to him are examples of these apostles and advertisers of the opening of possibility. He doesn't capitalize opening of possibility, but I think it's the same idea. The swarming apostles of life are harbingers of death. Much in the same way, let's try to substitute this. The swarming apostles of progress are harbingers of barbarism, backwardness, that this hyper-intention to bring about something can often, it has the unintended consequences of being self-defeating. Okay, so coming back to interdicts. By interdicts, it's almost humorous that, you know, we're here on page 72 and we finally get something that is like a definition. But by interdicts, I have intended those declared gifts of self-concealment that, faced with the frequent duplicities of their effect and practice, privileged knowledge dare only elaborate indirectly toward chafing defensive recognitions. Interdicts are of what is not to be done. That's as simple and as direct as brief is going to be. Interdicts are of what is not to be done. One of the things that is not to be done is endless self-expression, or a quest of endless self-expressiveness. That self-concealment is a gift, and that we can express and elaborate ourselves indirectly in a civilized manner. This almost makes us think of what is often a kind of a British stereotype, that to be civilized means, in part, to self-conceal and to be indirect. And I think in the civilizational imagination, it is distinct from the American style of being more verbose and expressive and direct. Negative gifts, declared inhibitions of what will be done, cannot allow themselves to be taught directly in a classroom. Here is one way in which we teachers dare not, if we would teach, pretend to be apostles. The teachers should not position themselves as people who have the answers to life's problems. Whatever life is, whatever progress is, that just sort of, it is not the activity of a good teacher to pretend that they can skip to the last page and give the answers of life and living, how to be and how to think and feel and conduct oneself. This is not an appropriate role for a teacher. Or rather, one who does this, who engages in this kind of sophistry, this kind of asexual reproduction, is not a real teacher. Remissions. So we have this, I think again, where Reef is kind of backtracking and giving us some, attempting to give some definitions for terms he's been using extensively. Remissions are positive acceptances. What is not done yet within the culture and in particular circumstances, done. Dreaming is the harmless paradigm of remissive action. So interdicts are what is not to be done. Transgressiveness is just the inversion of interdicts. It's whatever the interdicts say is not to be done is to be done, right? Transgression, transgressiveness is doing what you know ought not to be done. And remissions, again, as I've stated, they suggest a kind of a willingness to compromise. Well, you know, maybe it's not so bad. I mean, that it's a compromise, it's a weakening, it's an attitude that leads towards transgressiveness. It cracks the door open, whereas transgressiveness flings the door fully open. Skipping ahead. A true prophet is called to conserve what is being destroyed. Problem solvers parody prophecy. They call themselves to destroy what may be possible still to conserve. I'm just going to read it again. A true prophet is called to conserve what is being destroyed. Problem solvers parody prophecy. So again, this might seem strange to the listening audience. Problem solvers here is used with disdain, with a kind of a haughtiness, that it's seen as a I think this is really the template that the phrase critical thinking wouldn't really have been in common practice here. I think that's exactly the same target that Reef has here. Problem solvers, or critical thinkers, parody prophecy. They call themselves to destroy what may be possible still to conserve. This makes me think of a Nietzsche quote. He says it's about perverse wizards, right? So perverse wizards seek to create nothing out of the world rather than creating the world out of nothing. So if there could be a true magical wizard, then such a person would, in a way, have access to the power of creation, that they can create the world out of nothing. And for Nietzsche, I think, well, if we map a Reefian twist onto it, that these kind of therapeutic, false prophets, problem solvers, interdisciplinarians, etc., that instead of making the world out of nothing, they want to make nothing out of the world. They're perverse wizards, to use a Nietzschean phrase. Okay. Paratherapists. Thousands among our young have taken the paratherapists seriously, and moreover, take their courses in order to relieve, in school, of all places, and in courses, of all things, frustrations. That relieving frustrations, this Freudian sense of catharsis, perhaps, that young people have taken paratherapists seriously and think that school and courses is an appropriate venue for relieving their frustrations, to relieve themselves. Under this tutelage in soullessness of use and movement identical with faith and apathy, the therapeutic, as a characterless type, appears loyal solely to the promise of the next possibility. Only loyal to the promise of the next possibility. Again, no presiding presence, just order hopping from one order to the next. So far have we been taken down the road by the cultists of experiences. I think here this is kind of a bit of a jab at Dewey, but really it's just the way that the educational endeavor has become Deweyfied. And right around the exact time that Reef is writing here, we have the kind of the next iteration of Dewey with Paulo Freire. But these cultists of experience, that these therapeutic types who say that, you know, education can be a therapeutic playground for students to relieve their frustrations, rather than engage in any kind of a civilized, concealed commitment to form and knowledge. A symptom of the contemporary identity crisis, through which, Marx thought, classed men would evolve into man without class. In Nietzsche, the metamorphosis Judeo-Christian becomes yet another grandly articulated gesture by the re-educated classes to erase their historical memories. So getting rid of class is here related to this notion of erasing historical memories, which I think is an intuitive point if we add in the historical reality of cultural revolutions, this sense of creative destruction. Beware of unpriestly therapeutic false apostles and prophets. Okay, so coming to the last page here. I'll stop just after maybe one more paragraph here on page 88. With easy access to all meanings and possessed by none, my counter-ideal type, growing fastest in America, but not here alone, edges nearer and nearer a condition of life entirely free from the sacred and its prohibitions. That the endless expressional characterless personality type is in a way free from limits, unlimited, and totally unrestrained or unconstrained, and just divorced from any sense of sacredness or prohibition. Again, this idea of concealment that Brief describes in multiple different ways. And this is simply a way of thinking about freedom, thinking actually more in terms of liberation, right? That liberation is this activity towards a freedom that is being denied. Denied perhaps in a kind of a Gnostic sense, but primarily thinking of freedom as inclination, that acting upon desire and constraints placed upon desire. For example, not being able to use a university class or course or campus to relieve your own frustrations. I mean, that participates very squarely in this expressional quest. But thinking instead of freedom in a more civilized way, that true freedom is entirely, well, it should be conceived more along the lines of liberty. And, you know, liberty necessitates constraints. Because we, in order for everyone to be able to exercise their liberty, no one can exercise their freedom in such a way that it imposes or, you know, debilitates the other. But that, I suppose, is more social, and the anti-culture that Reef is against here is much more psychological, that it thinks much more of the self and the ego in its therapeutic situation as a kind of an isolated atom, and less in terms of a citizen of a republic or a democracy. Thinking of freedom and liberation and inclination and desire all, on the one hand in a kind of a therapeutic way, but really this therapeutic almost hides the way to which this is played out in a large scale through politics and in institutions like universities. Okay, so I will stop here and we'll continue from right around page 90 onward. And I suppose I'll do two more short ones, but possibly I'll just do one more long form. And as we try to finish, I mean, actually, I'm really less than halfway through the text here. But maybe I can start to go a little bit faster. And I think I should be able to do one more episode, I think. And then we can move on. I think after Reef, we'll be moving out of the 70s in terms of this chronological lit review. I'm quite sure. Yeah, first published in 1973. So hopefully we can finish up the 70s, move into the 80s, 90s, because I've still got a whole lit review that that extends far beyond this, and we've just been doing the roots in kind of a deep dive sort of a way. So, thank you very much for listening. This has been Unchanging Education with me, Dan Clements.